Robert Henke is one of the, I can say, most kaleidoscopic contemporary artists invited at the last Music Venice Biennale. And Robert works on the border among art, sound, technology, and science. As a sound and as a digital artist, as an hardware engineer, and as a software programmer, he has released in almost 30 years of activity. Music compositions, audiovisual installations, and computer graphics. And his production have been presented at the Tate Modern in London, just to name a few, Centre Pompidou in Paris, and Palazzo dell'Esposizione in Rome, or KW, Institute of Contemporary Art in Berlin, and was also presented in a large number of festivals. Like CTM, NewTek, and Sonar, and many others. His music project Monolake, that started in 1995, if I'm correct, is considered as a milestone, as an icon of a music scene emerging in Berlin after the fall of the wall until today. And Robert is also one of the main creators of Ableton Live. We're talking about 1999 2000, together with Gerard Beles. And Ableton Live is a software which no need any presentation, being basically the standard for many music production and performance practice of electronic music. So I'm really honored to have the chance to talk with you, Robert. So welcome, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Marco, for the great introduction, and I'm very happy about this talk.
Yeah, as we were start discussing, it's quite difficult to discuss how many things you do. Okay, how really kaleidoscopic is your activity? Also, because it's very interesting to me as you define yourself on your website, as a definition that you give up yourself as a digital artist, also as a musician, software engineer, hardware engineer. But you consider yourself as a digital artist, which is very interesting to me.
Well, it is really hard to find a description that explains what I'm doing, since for me all the different activities are fueled from a common interest in the same topics. I'm interested in time, in timbres, in spaces, and I'm also interested in being creative with computers.
Yeah.
And making music is a huge part of that. But if I, for instance, work on installations, then the visual art I'm doing is following exactly the same principles than my compositions or my performances. And it is really about exploring how I can achieve my ideas using technology, and how to be inspired by technology, and how to also develop technology to achieve things that I want to do. So in a way, I am in a dialogue with my machinery all the time, and I find this very inspiring.
Yeah, I agree with you also, because we come back, in a way. We will finish our conversation coming back, to this idea of being an artist today, and being an artist working, especially working with science and technology, and with scientific research, scientific method more in general. But I mean, it would be the end, in a way, of this conversation, because I imagine this conversation as a sort of a circle, okay? So with a starting point and an ending point that conjunct themselves, and it would be something on which I would like to come back. But I mean, the starting point of this conversation, I wanted to be a sort of an antidote, and because we are talking about September 2007, and we are talking about Tesla Cultural Scientific Center in Berlin that doesn't exist anymore, and that was the very first time that I met your art and sound installations. after being basically a great fan of you as a monolake, okay? So as for your music, at that time you were exposing the Atom performance installation together with Christopher Bowder, and that was also the very first time that you were hosting on my online platform, Digico, that was born 2 years before with an interview with Bertram Nissen. And the article is still linked on the CDM online website, which is one of the references that you have on your Atom webpage on your website. And so just to describe, Atom is an 8x8 sort of a matrix array of white self-illuminated balloons floating in the space according to textural sonic events, like the atoms, okay, in a sort of a complex molecule. So like the natural and sound elements composing the reality in which we live as human beings, having a physical, perceptual and embodied perception of the world. I can say that you have been always a sort of a deep philosophically and scientific vision of your music and artistic creation, isn't it? That's something that I felt since the very, very beginning.
I try to combine a logical or technology-driven approach with a very deep desire to achieve something that is emotional. And as much as I like thinking about technical problems and solutions, ultimately what I find most rewarding is if I can achieve a state where the people who are listening or watching my work are not thinking anymore about the mechanics, but they start to see something different. When you watch a movie, you forget that you're in a cinema. And ideally, what I hope I can achieve in my best works is that people, very soon after they are immersed with it, stop thinking about how it's been done and all these things, but just enjoy the experience. And interestingly, in order to make this happen, it has to be technically perfect. So if the technology needs to be good, or it doesn't disappear.
And when you talking about technology, when you work on the also the technological part of the sound that you use, you work with, you like to work with a sort of a microscopic nature of the sound. Is a feeling of mine as part of the audience, or is something that is really interesting for you to work on this idea of a microscopic nature of sound?
Well, the beauty of working with electronic sound generation is that I have access to all these details and that I can go very deep into very short periods of time and can shape things very precisely. This was something that I always admired when I was young already. The fact that you can be so precise with electronics. The challenge that comes with this access is that it's easy to get lost. So I have to force myself to stop at some point refining things and say, what is the big gesture I want to deliver, and focus on that one.
Yeah. And also when talking about, you know, continue talking about this idea of an interest of you, not only of you, okay, of some musicians more in general, specifically for you, on this microscopic nature of sound. You have worked also as, computer, hardware and software, okay, engineers and creating tools. Like, for example, I'm thinking about, for example, the Granulator 2 synthesizer, you know, for Max4Live. And it is based on the on some principles of quasi-synchronous, okay, granular synthesis, talking about granular synthesis, so the granular part of the audio synthesis on one side, and this idea of being synchronous, but not completely, you know, synchronous, not completely geometrical. So in a way, accepting the idea of being also random or being or having errors, as you were saying, you know, in this idea of a continuous research. Why, in your opinion, I mean, working on this primordial nature of sound is so important for you specifically, or more in general, you know, also for some musicians working with electronic music and sounds as a speculative sort of investigation, I can say.
Well, for me, sound is very similar to what paint is for a painter. And if I'm able to very precisely define the texture of my work, this makes a lot of a difference. There is this philosophy in Asian Japanese art that things start to get interesting if there's a certain amount of error in it.
Yeah.
So if it's just perfect, then it's boring. And if it's absolutely perfect, and then there's a part that has an imperfection, this tension creates an interest. And when I'm creating sound, I use a lot of technologies that involve certain amounts of randomness. So there is some unpredictability. And this is what we human beings usually enjoy. When we look at a beautiful forest in the fall, we see trees. And that's maybe all the same trees, but every single tree is slightly different. And every color is slightly different. Every leaf looks a bit different. And we cannot stop watching at the colorful leaves in the fall because every single of them is different. And we look at one and then we try to find another one that's more beautiful. If they would be all perfectly the same, it would be pretty much a nightmare.
I agree with you. I agree with you. It's a sort of a, you know, uniform kind of a visual nightmare, you know, without any references. I can say that probably also from a mental point of view, in terms of possible connection between our mind, our senses, you know, and the sensorial apparatus connected to our eyes, it creates sort of a differences and balances. And it is allowed to do this also, as you were saying, because we perceive differences in things. Otherwise, if everything is the same, basically, from a visual point of view, it would be, that would be not for us the chance to perceive possible patterns or possible differences. And it works also with sound, right? It's quite the same. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's also the beauty of listening to acoustic instruments. You strive for perfection, but at the same time, there is all this inherent imperfections that make the sound interesting.
In a way, in your creations, I mean, both in music also, and probably more, I mean, in sound installations or live performances, but I can say also in your monolith production, it's a sort of a double nature, double balance, okay, between on one side, computational, electronic, music composition, balancing, you know, in a way from mathematical patterns of sounds on one side, so moving also through the physical space, and as we were saying, a sort of a random and generative algorithms creating sort of a non-conventional landscape. So is a continuous balance between something which is very, and you perceive as very geometrical and very linear in a way, and on the other side, something that is related to more random, you know, and non-conventional kind of acoustic landscapes. And I always thought, when I had the chance to join your live performances or your sound installation, this idea that it also helps, you know, the audience from a visual point of view, indeed, in terms that it helps the audience to visualize, okay, a sort of a sonic architecture of the physical world surrounding, you know, the people itself. And is it something important for you in a way as an artist to have this sort of a possible, given the audience this sort of a possible visualization of the sonic architecture that you create, working with the sound to help, you know, this kind of abstract visualization that you do not see properly with the eye. You perceive with the sound, with the ears, okay, with your acoustic apartment in a way, but it works also from a visual point of view. Is it only a metaphor for you, or is something that is something on which you work and which you are interested in?
It depends. There is projects or performances of mine where I tried to add a visual component, mainly because I thought it is some kind of convention. And I learned that it's much better if I perform these pieces without any visualization, because the music itself requires so much attention that any sort of additional visual information is taking focus away. So it really is a question that I have to answer on a piece by piece basis. I also learned that some of my installations work better without any sound for exactly the same reason. Where a visual component in itself is so strong that adding a sound feels arbitrary. And then there's, of course, maybe the majority of my works where I develop the sound and the visual side together as one unity from the start, where already in the process of composition, I am not starting writing the music and then adding a visual layer, or creating a visual layer and then scoring the music to it. But instead of thinking about what interesting sonic elements do I have, what interesting visual things can I provide, and how could those elements fit together? And the CBM AD32 AV project is a classical example for this one. We were developing the sonic possibilities of the instrument, so writing the computer code to make these computers make sound, and writing the computer code to create these interesting, very limited but charming visual gestures before actually composing the pieces. So I created an instrument that creates sound and an instrument that creates some sort of video. And once the instruments were done, or in the process of creating these instruments, I started to shape the pieces. And the pieces were shaped already with the idea in mind of combining those two elements. And that is a very different process of thinking than the classical thinking of first the music or first the video.
Yeah, it seems that, I mean, this idea of creating tools, creating instruments is always, you know, at the core of every production of you, or I mean, many, or a very high percentage, I can say, of
I
the
agree.
production
Yeah.
of you.
Yeah. No, this, I might say I'm an instrument builder by heart. I like instruments. And I also have a strong admiration for the people who in the past built great instruments in all centuries. Because as an instrument builder, you shape the music people later will make with these instruments. So it is not just an engineering task. You have to have an imagination and you have to have a vision for what you or someone else will do with the instrument later. And once the instrument is finished, it's always surprising what the instrument actually can do. So despite of being very analytical and logical on one side, there's a lot of room for uncertainty. There's a lot of room for discovery. And for me, this is a dialogue between the things I know and all the options that happen just because of putting together a few things that are known. That's fascinating for me that I can work with a few simple elements and I can completely understand how every single element works. And then I start combining them and I experience things that I never anticipated.
That's also very interesting because on also according to what happened this year that you were invited and celebrated, you know, by the Venice Biennale together with other of course great musicians and composers, but also this sort of a hybrid figure like you on one side or Miller Pucat for the other side, for example, which is very interesting to me as a critic, because especially music, but also in visual arts, but especially music, this is a sort of a separation in a way of values. It seems to be a sort of a separation of value in terms of who is a composer, who is a more academic composer, who is more an electronic musician coming from the techno scene, for example, or also who is an engineer working, you know, with a creative approach to the instrument itself. You know, that's very interesting. And it seems like what is important, in my opinion, as a figure of you, a person like you, an artist like you, it doesn't give a shit about these separations, and it stay perfectly, you know, on the balance of the. Of all these words, which is your feeling about it?
It took me very long to come to that stage where I feel actually comfortable with this role. It is so much not what is accepted as a role model in our culture. When I grew up in a family of engineers, and it was clear that I'm a technically minded person. But at the same time, it was also clear that due to the fact that I am an engineer, I cannot be an artist. So there was this kind of a mutual exclusivity between, oh, this is a technical person and this is an artist. This very strange vision that the engineer is logical and that there's no inspiration whatsoever needed to build great instruments, machines, tools. And on the other side, there's the artist who is this creative, chaotic person who is not structured in any way and where the imagination and the inspiration just falls from the sky. And I sometimes wish, especially in education, that we are tearing down these boundaries and show people that in order to build good engineering, you have to be creative. And in order to be a good artist, you have to know your instruments and you have to understand the mechanics behind it. And things are getting better, I believe, in a younger generation for whom technology is just more a normal way of expression. And that is quite inspiring and encouraging. But for me personally, it took very long time to accept that writing code and soldering things is just part of what I do as an artist.
And I think, can you confirm me that this scientific mind, I can say, I don't know if you like this idea or like a metaphor like this, but having this scientific mind helped you also to develop a sort of, or I give you a chance also to be specific, peculiar, and yourself as an artist from a creative, artistic point of view, right? Are not two separate kind of parts of your brain in a way.
No, absolutely. I feel the same amount of achievement if I'm in the studio and I manage to finish a piece that I'm happy with, or if I'm sitting in front of a lot of paper and my laptop and finishing a piece of software. In both cases, if things are good, I feel a certain sense of elegance and beauty. And another very important aspect is the type of inspiration artistically I get out of solving technical problems. Because technology in itself is never transparent. Every instrument you build, every tool you create suggests ways to use it. You know, if you build a drum kit, then you have a bunch of percussive sounds. So you do a rhythmical music. And if I build a piece of software that allows to cut recordings into millions of little particles, then it is very likely that a certain type of music comes out of this just as a result. And so what happened for me is that I built my instruments with a certain idea in mind, what I want to do with them. But I might at some point later use them for completely different things because the technology told me a different way. So I find new artistic inspiration based on my technology. But since this is my personal technology, which I developed for myself, it also has a strong personal quality. So all these things are, in my opinion, great positive aspects of my work. The big downside of my approach is that it takes forever. Instead of just using what other people did, I am so stubborn that I always try to reinvent the wheel. And I can't stop doing this because I find it fascinating. And if I have good luck, I discover something new on the way. But there's also a risk that I'm just wasting a lot of time.
What is interesting that you can also compare to visual arts created with computers and digital technologies, I mean, which is basically the world to which I belong more, okay? As a professional, I mean, as a teacher, as an educator, as a lecturer, as a writer. That's, in a way, that's a sort of a comparison, you know? When you have the ability or the skills or even the chance, okay, to work on the technology itself, on the very core of a specific technology, which can be a hardware or a software technology. Think about the artificial intelligences, you know, that are now bouncing up and being more and more actual in a way. If you are able to program your own software machine or your hardware machine, in a way, you would be more free. Okay, you would have more technical chances to develop also your creative and artistic idea instead of using softwares or machines, both, I mean, virtual or physical, that are all the other people are using at the same level, okay? Being, of course, more and more skilled, but at the end, is a closed machine. While when you create an open machine, because you created both programming or engineering, you have more chances also to develop, you know, your creative and artistic ideas.
Yes and no. Since I cannot compete, for instance, with big commercial tools, my own tools, and I'm not talking about, of course, Ableton Live, I talk about the stuff I write for my performances, are very limited. So in a way, I have much less options than everyone else. But the interesting part of it is that I choose my options very deliberately. So since creating my own tools for my performances takes time, I think a lot before I'm doing it, what is the goal I have? And I rule out a lot of things that I don't want to do. And this is something that is, for an artist, always very helpful. So I spend a lot of time thinking, what is it really I want to do? And then I try to achieve exactly this. And this gives me some focus. So writing my own tools forces me to be focused and forces me to be stubborn enough to say, no, I do this. Mm-hmm. So once again, with the old computers, when I finally decided I do this, there was no turning back. It had to work. And it was a very, very long and very exhausting journey with a lot of moments where I thought we will never be able to pull this off. But since I already invested so much time in it, I decided to really, really push it through. And ultimately, I believe it's one of my best works because the situation of doing the seemingly impossible required for me to come up with very unique artistic questions and answers. And therefore, this is a very personal and very unique work that could only become that personal and unique because I did all this work by myself.
Yeah. But it never happened to you that, I mean, I don't know, an idea, okay, of a new, for the new experimentation field, new artwork starts from the artwork before. I mean, starts from the researches that you did for an installation or for an artwork before. Maybe a path that you didn't follow because of you were at that time focused on something else, but you see a sort of a potential on that path, on that search that eventually you give it there parked, okay, in a corner of your mind, and you say, okay, I want to come back there for the next project.
It happens. Absolutely. There's this whole bunch of happy accidents where you do something and either you make a mistake or the results are just the way they are, turn out to be not helpful, useful, whatever, for the current project. But I have a feeling in the back of my head that there's something there that is interesting. And then I either make them notes or I save it somewhere on a hard disk or by any other means. And potentially, sometimes even years later, I come back to it. I think, hey, this is interesting. That happens a lot. And this is also something that I like as a working method. Never throw things away. Always consider that even if it's not the right thing for the moment, it might be something that is useful in another context. And sometimes what I'm just doing is I go through the folders on my hard drive and see what did I do 10 years ago and not finish. And suddenly there's something which back in the days I did not consider important. And I see it, I listen to it, I try it out, and I think, okay, it's not finished, but there's a core of an idea that I should explore.
That's also very interesting. It happened also to me sometimes as a writer. I mean, sometimes exactly. Sometimes also because I have a scientific background, for example. So what you were talking about before, it happened to me as well in the last 15 years, because when I started, we are talking about, the first years of around 2002, 2003, Digicom started in 2005. I mean, I had a scientific degree. Okay. So I'm a chemist as a degree. And so when I started, in a way, I was also sort of a weird kind of creatures, working in contemporary art, but without having, a contemporary art background, coming, from a more scientific world, but being interested in the crossing border between technology, science, and arts and music. I mean, that I think that was an advantage to me in a way. I was not so much academic from the beginning. I became, a new kind of academic, but 15 years later. At the beginning, I was so interviewing. I was interested, to overcross all the balances and words. That was something, I mean, fresh at that time, and it happened to me, to start and being recognized as a sort of a weird creature interested in many things that could be connected together. And it happens to me sometimes right now to open a folder and say, "What I was writing, 10, 15 years ago." That was, I mean, in a way naive, but at the same time interesting, to develop with a new light that I have today. It happened to you as well, in a way. But it happened to you in this direction. So, for example, for CBM 8032AB that you presented at the Venice Biennale, it started from something like that?
Not for this project, because it was so radically different from all the previous things. But the CBM project fueled a lot of other things. So the things I developed for it created options for working on things that are somehow related to it, but different. Most important, the necessity of being very reduced had a huge impact on my general idea about composition. So When working with electronic media these days, we are all used to the fact that the only limit is the speed of your computer, and well, buy a larger one or use 2 or 3 or 10. It doesn't really matter. But with this specific project, I had 3 computers that are making sound, and each computer can only make 1 sound at a time, which basically makes this a chamber music piece. It's not a full ensemble, it's chamber music. And it forced me to develop a compositional style that I was not used to. And this reduction turned out to be so immensely important for my own musical evolution, because it forced me to really come down with the essence. What is ornament? What can go away? And what is the core? And focus on the things that really matter in every single individual sound. And the amount of knowledge I gained just from this project, knowledge that has nothing to do with technology, with really knowledge in terms of how to compose, that was unexpected, and this was very rewarding.
Yeah, also because it seems like as another brick, as another step, you know, in the chain of your research, in terms of working on the deep granular nature of sound, you know, instead of doing this with the granulator, you're doing directly with computers. Being every single computer is connected to every single sound, you have a sort of a hybrid feature creating, you know, a complex sound from singular and minimal elements, which is also very interesting, because you're coming back to the with CBM, you came back to the very nature of the computer itself as a source of sound. Is this something that matches with the idea and the concept behind CBM? That was my feeling. I didn't have the chance to watch the performance in Venice, but I had in Modena 1 year ago. So I had this feeling in Modena, for example.
Well, the fact that the generation of sound is so much connected to the program that does it, it's such a simple machine, makes it all very raw and at the same time also intricate. And that is, it's a very direct way of thinking. So there is not many layers in between. When you make sound with a computer these days, you know, you have your computer, which is a normal general machine made by some company, and then there's some software on this machine made by another company, and then there's a sound card which is made by another company. It all feels very indirect in a way, and also not very personal, because you're depending on so many things you have to buy from, actually even sources that have nothing to do with music. And if I play with my own old computers, with my own very simple software, it's a very direct experience. It's very immediate. I don't feel a distance between my ideas and the result. And it's, again, much closer to using your own voice for sonic expression, or using a pen to paint or to write. It's simple, but it's very personal. And that shapes the result.
Even the visual part, right?
Yes.
I had a feeling also with the visual part. Being, so low information kind of visual patterns, it's very interesting also in opposition to the overbounce, overlay, and over, you know, stimulated kind of visual digital art that is happening around today. That's very interesting as well.
I mean, honestly, I was worried that people would be annoyed if they have to watch for 1 hour a green screen. And it turned out that it's completely fine.
Why? What you think about?
Well, when you create something, there's always moments of doubt. You always think, it might not be good enough. People won't like it. I won't like it. And I thought it might be exhausting and boring to look at old computer graphics in one single color in green for 1 hour. And as a matter of fact, it's not boring at all. And once again, after a certain time, you forget that it's green. You forget that it's a computer screen. You're just immersed in a new world. And that, once again, is the best thing you can achieve with art.
Absolutely. And according also the feature part of some, of course, of your, but some at the same time, a very high percentage of your live performances and also installations. I would think about the last part of your productions that were related to the use of the lasers. Okay, that's also very interesting to me. Because if we remember that laser acronym, it means, if I remember well, light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation, right? Lasers, yeah. In other words, it's a light emission which is coherent and discrete, functional, stimulated by an electromagnetic wave, and so like a sound wave, for example. Talking about the visual part of some slash many
the laser
your, yeah productions and artworks, I mean in the last years you were more and more focused and interested in the use of the laser, and if we remember what laser means, I mean it's an acronym for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation, and so in other words, a sort of a light emission that is coherent and discrete, which is stimulated by an electromagnetic wave and also possibly by a sound wave. And so if an artist like you work with the granular wave sound particles with the punctual nature of sound, it I think it perfectly match, you know, with laser as a possible visual to visual representation of your sound architectures. And according to this vision of mine, I'm thinking about the deep web installation and performance that I had the chance to join in 2016 or 17, I don't remember well, at the CTM in Berlin. And it has a speculative reference, okay, to the world of nature in a way, because it seems like a not human creature, an animal creature floating above the head of the audience, breathing sounds and enlightening, you know, its skeleton according to external stimuli. That's something that it is at the base of your idea. It was a wrong feeling of mine, or it agrees also with your vision.
It makes perfect sense. I really like the idea of seeing this installation or many other installations as kind of mechanical creatures, the human part or the animalistic part in it is, I think, is relevant and very important. There is a life in the machine, you know, there is some beauty in it that comes from mechanical movement that at the same time is very physical. I mean, we're living in a time of simulation. You know, we're talking here and we don't see each other. We look at a computer screen, and looking at a physical object and seeing a physical object moving, or seeing a laser beam, which in a strange way also has a physicality to it. That is something that is a different experience. And we have bodies, we human beings, we are used through all our existence to interact with physical objects. And as soon as we experience something that, at least in theory, could be touched, that gives us a different feeling than if it's something that is purely virtual. And yeah, I don't know if you have seen this before, but if you have a laser beam and there's fog in the air, and then the beam becomes very visible. And if the beam is in such a position that people can put their hand through, they always do, all the time. So there's a deep desire to touch the physicality of light and to interact with it in a physical way. And this is beautiful. And I really like that. I like the idea that there's a physical interaction between people and objects.
Yeah. And also, that's interesting also how, you know, this system in terms of the object, the light, and the audience interact themselves also according to the environment in which they are. Because I have chances in my life, for example, with the UVA installation or with Edwin van der Heide, also LSP performance, I remember many years ago. And it's also different than, you know, according to the space in which you are, the architecture of the space in which you move. In deep web is also interesting because this creature, you know, is above you, is really floating, you know, above your head. It's there. You cannot properly touch it, you know, but in a way, it seems that you can. And it's a sort of a tension. And this tension, I think, is at the pace of that installation or many other performances of you using the lasers.
Yeah, I think so. It's a bit of a tease in a way. You know, you're so close. You are so close to be able to really grab it, but you can't. And maybe this is kind of triggering some very old tribal instincts of us human beings. You know, you want to catch the bird. You want to fly with the birds. Walk to the end of the rainbow and see where it hits the ground. And all these kind of things. Or you want to go up to the mountain just because you see it and you want to go up there. There is this desire to reach the things you can't reach or are hard to reach. That is a very, very strong force in our lives.
That's true. And if you notice, of course you noticed, what is technological art more in general? There is this new tension, you know, to come back to the physical body. First of all, because, I mean, of course, technology and scientific research is allowing, you know, this process on one side, but on the other side, in a way, it seems that after 20, 25, 30 years, you know, of sound and visual experimentations using digital tools, in a way, there is a strong tension and a strong acceptance, and in a way, the feeling of the audience itself to come back to a more physical, you know, and sensorial experience. That's a feeling of mine, even, I mean, both in sound art or in visual art. Digital is interesting, of course, is potential, is of course, but in a way, I mean, that's something that is coming back to the body, you know, to the physicality of our, I mean, sensorial physical experiences.
Well, this is why it's so important for me to present these five old computers on stage in this kind of theater setting, because the magic comes from the fact that I'm not pretending that there is some technology doing something, but it's visible. This is very clearly visible old objects that have their physical properties, including the weird shape and the old CRT display and the keyboard and everything. And they are there on stage facing the audience. And I play with these physical objects. This is a very different experience than if I would be in front of a laptop, even if I would achieve the same results. That the magic to a certain degree comes from the fact that for everyone, it's on a very emotional level possible to experience these machines are doing it. And that changes the perception. It's like if you're in front of a very old mechanical calculator and you're amazed by the fact that someone built this, even if it's slow and it can only add two small numbers whilst your smartphone can do the calculations necessary to land a moon lander.
And if you think about it, this is a process that belongs, you know, to the history of any artistic or, I mean, musical movement, you know. I mean, discovering the new things coming because of technological scientific developments, but at the same time, when a sort of a plateau is reached in a way, also to rediscover and to reuse and misuse also past experiences exploring, new possible territories. And I think this is the moment, these years in which we're living, it's really happening something like this.
I mean, we live in strange times in many, many ways, where we try to make sense of the past in order to understand the present and shape ideas of the future. I think you cannot envision a future without understanding the past. And this is true in an artistic field. This is true environmentally. This is true politically, on a social level. I guess this is very universal. Every progress is based on an understanding of the past.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you. Okay, Robert, as I told you at the beginning, I want to come back, and close the circle. I want to come back to the very beginning of our conversation. And I'm asking you to be a little bit patient. I'm asking also to the people that who are listening to us to be patient, because I want to read a quote of you that you wrote a few time ago for an article which is on your website, absolutely interesting to me, and I usually suggest also to my students, that is entitled A Question of Wording, Science and Research in Digital Art, okay? And the quote is, it became quite en vogue to link arts, especially digital arts, with science and research. And that link is a bit asymmetrical. It is artists who claim to be researchers, labeling their work as science, and not so much molecular biologists who include references to work of art in their conference paper. Skipping a little bit, continuing the quote, you say, calling artistic practice science is pretentious. The creation of a work of art has not so much to do with classical research in natural sciences. The research is not about the creation of an artwork. It is about the tools used for it. If you don't do something that is worth being published in, say, Scientific American or Physics Review, just label it art, not science. So at the last Music Venice Biennale, you had also the chance to run, a lecture called Art, Science, and Technology. I don't know if this was a title, given by the people working at the Venice Biennale, or was a title that you suggested. But the title was Art, Science, and Technology. So I can ask you to go, in conclusion, a bit more deep, okay, inside this quote, inside this idea, because it's quite radical, I can say, right?
Well, the context of this statement was that we live in times where, on one side, information is more available than ever before in human history. And therefore, you would assume that it's easier for people to gain objective knowledge about how the world works. But at the same time, the very opposite is happening, that there is more and more people, or at least there's a perception of this, who create their own very personal realities, and which is not a problem as long as it stays personal, but are using those personal realities to debate things that are pretty essential. And as someone who has a strong affinity to science and to the achievements of science, I'm of course scared if suddenly things like viruses become opinions. If even high-ranked politicians who have the power to shape how we are living in the future are guided by ideas of science that are very unscientific. I see a danger in there, a danger that is very tangible and will affect us. If people say, well, I don't believe in climate change, as if this is a question of belief and not of data you can validate, then we have a problem. And from this background, I found it even more difficult if everything is labeled science, because if I label everything science, then at the end, nothing is science anymore. So if I can say I did some breakfast research this morning and I did some paper folding research this afternoon when I was bored, then it seems that research is this kind of thing that everyone can do in their living room if they have nothing better to do. And that my results of my coffee making research are as valid and important as the results of figuring out how a certain cancer is spreading in the body for which reasons. And therefore, I am a friend of trying to use the right terminology, basically to protect the specific traits that use this terminology from being diluted with things that make no sense. I would also not expect that someone who is, or I would expect that someone who is talking about art knows the right terminology so that I'm able to communicate with that person and then I can exchange artistic ideas. My point was that the wording matters, which I wrote in my article, and that I prefer that we as artists, for what we are doing, we find words that are not so ambiguous. And it's hard, it's difficult. I have to admit that it's very easy sometimes to use the term research. I'm searching for something, but I wish there would be a different terminology that would distinguish my artistic research, for the lack of a better term at the moment, from the type of research that is done, for instance, in the natural sciences. I believe it would serve both of us. It would serve the scientists and it would serve the artists better if there would be a clearer distinction. And I mean, I don't know. At the end of the day, that was just a personal opinion, which came out of being a bit annoyed by a bunch of artists who, in my opinion, are choosing the are labeling their work too freely with this science label to make it important. And to me, feels a bit cheap. But this is also driven by an art world, especially, who still today seem to be so fascinated by technology without really understanding it.
Yeah.
Which brings us back to the global topic of education. If you can't talk with an art curator about what exactly you're doing technically because that person has no clue about your instrument but has an opinion, that makes it really difficult. You would expect that a curator who collects Renaissance paintings knows a bit about how to paint in oil. And then you have curators curating digital art exhibitions who have absolutely no clue about the basics of what the artists are doing. But instead of admitting they have no clue, they're copying some complete brain dead advertisement text. And yeah, that's just not me. I'm too much a scientist to engage in that game.
I totally agree with you, Robert. We could continue to talk about this topic in a second episode. Okay.
I'm afraid this last part is way too negative to be part of the thing.
I don't think it's negative. I think it's conscious, first of all, and could be partly agreed and partly not, of course. But at the same time, it's important to reflect both on the terminology on one side. I totally agree with you. And on competence, you know, of background and competence of the people working in the field of the digital art. And if you think also about sound digital music, because it's something, you know, in a way that it's as a curator as well, as a critic and as a curator. First of all, I'm always interested in techniques. I was always interested in techniques, probably because of my scientific background on one side. And second of all, I totally respect the artists I work with usually, because I don't have the whole knowledge, you know, also from a technical point of view of what they are doing, but also eventually a critical approach, you know, to the final outcome, to the aesthetics, the narrative, the visual language or the sound language in a way. I don't know which is the completely 100% the technical background behind it, which is many times absolutely interesting and needed of respect. And so that's something that I totally agree with you. And that's something that happened in the last 20 years, and it's happening now when the new trends related to digital, you know, digital technologies, both in visual and sound arts, are coming more and more trendy, are coming more and more popular, are coming more and more institutional. And of course, many, many people, you know, a growing number of people, are professional people, are being interested in that without having a clue of how they work also, and which are the potentials and the limits and the biases eventually working with specific technologies, which is a problem. I agree with you.
I think the key to become good in whatever you are doing is to understand the things you don't know.
Absolutely. Or being curious to know
being
more.
Curious is one thing, but it's really helpful to understand that where the limits of knowledge are, you know, instead of pretending that everything is clear. I very much know where my limits are in many, many fields of technology. And knowing that limits allows me to say, okay, here I can't comment because I have no clue. And the same is true, of course, for artistic fields. I don't need to pretend that I'm familiar with the work of artist X, Y, Z. Because if I'm not, then it's better to just say, no, I have no idea. Can you show me what they are doing? So instead of pretending, I try to learn. Because we can't just accept that the world is so complex and so rich and interesting.
Absolutely.
That there's no chance that one can know everything.
And the reason also why I consider your article interesting, and the reason why I always, you know, forward that article to my students, for example, is that the problem of wording is interesting also from a philosophical, historical point of view. Because as we were saying before, I mean, we are living in a period, fortunately, on one side, if you think, in which, I mean, the separations, you know, the disciplinary separation between technology and sound, between art and music, and design and architecture, you know, all this kind of binary separations are collapsing, fortunately, from a cultural point of view. And that's interesting because on one side, it's philosophically and speculative, very interesting for people like me as a writer, and for people like you as an artist, and or for philosophers, for example. But on the other side, it takes, you know, problems like wording, for example, and appropriation in a way, cultural appropriation.
Absolutely.
Of cultural fits that do not properly belong to you, and that it's better to having a conversation, you know, a dialogue with different words instead of appropriating, you know, the milestones of that specific word that is useful to your career or to your creation in a way. I don't know. That's my feeling.
No, I agree. Absolutely.
Okay, Robert. I thank you very much. It was really a pleasure and an honor to have this conversation with you. And I hope there will be other chances to have more.